You're listening to The Exchange. I'm Mary Hartnett. Iowa Supreme Court Chief Justice Mark Cady died suddenly last Friday. Cady's family announced the death of the 66-year-old Chief Justice following a heart attack at the family home in Fort Dodge. Republican Governor Kim Reynolds says she met with Cady a few times this year, and they were both passionate about criminal justice reform. She says he talked a lot about specialty courts that focus on family, drug, and business issues.
One of the things that he really implemented that was important to me was the fact that he took the courts on the road. And as somebody that comes from rural Iowa, to be able to see justice up close like that, I think really was an important thing to do and had a big impact on Iowans understanding the judicial system.
Cady was known to people nationally for his ruling on the Varnum v. O'Brien case on April 3, 2009, in which the court held that the state's limitation of marriage to opposite-sex couples violated the Equal Protection Clause of the Iowa Constitution. Judge Dwayne Hoffmeyer is the chief of the 3rd Judicial District in Iowa. He hears cases at the Woodbury County Courthouse. Hoffmeyer knew Cady well and says he was shocked when he found out about Cady's death.
We were just, all of the chief judges were just in Des Moines on Wednesday. And so, and at judicial council meeting, which is all of the chief judges, the 8 judicial districts, the Court of Appeals, and he chairs the meeting. And so, yeah, I mean, yeah, I wasn't aware of any health issues or anything of that nature. So it was a shock to many of us.
Yeah, because before that, I was just thinking, well, they'll have to start gearing up for the new year. And he always would give a presentation, a speech, the state of the judiciary. And I was wondering what he would say this year.
Mm-hmm. We reviewed budget matters for the upcoming legislative session. And, yeah, I think he was scheduled to speak on the 15th of January for the state of the judiciary speech. And so... we were kind of all looking forward to upcoming legislative session and things of that nature. And so, yeah, it was a big shock when I got a call Friday evening and let me know about it. So,
you know, a lot of people statewide talk about, especially, you know, the same-sex marriage ruling years ago that he had a hand in. But I can't help but think of the last few years and his efforts in a couple of areas. You know, and one of them was he was very concerned about the treatment of people with mental health problems in the court system and how they were cared for and the need to sort of help them out.
Mm-hmm. You know, he was looking a lot at the mental health issues, our jury system, and wanting to make sure that that we all judicial officers receive training on racial bias or implicit bias, and wanting us to, you know, do whatever we can do to make sure that those individuals in front of us got a fair shake and that we were trained and educated on some of these topics. And he was actively involved in trying to make the Iowa court system the best court system in the United States, and that's the way he always phrased it. And he was best known for probably every presentation he gave to, I bet, a lawyer group, and certainly judges always thanked him for their hard work and, you know, dedication and work. And at every judicial council meeting, he ended that with the same comments, and he always would make a point to go around the table and individually thank us for our work and our effort and our dedication and shake our hands. And he was just very, very compassionate, and fair person.
He was also concerned about the overall financial status and financial health of the court system when it seemed like a lot of county courts were having trouble staying open, that, you know, there seemed like there just wasn't enough money to go around to keep cases moving through.
I think the judicial branch budget has been challenging. We were trying to determine what to do with our small county courtrooms and courthouses and whether they should be merged or work moved from one to another. And And he worked through with the legislature on our judicial branch budget, and he typically would always promise them to keep full-time operations in all of their county courts. And we've been able to do that, and we've kind of have started in a little different initiative that would guarantee that they would stay open by kind of placing some of our the easiest way to say is we have Woodbury County people, employees that are residing in Cherokee County, and they're doing Woodbury County work, but they're available in Cherokee County to help the counter and, you know, during vacations and lunch breaks to make sure that they don't have to close. And that was one of Chief Justice Katie's more recent projects, was trying to solidify how some of these small rural courthouses could remain viable. And this is one of the ways that we're moving in that direction.
Yeah, because I know that especially in the smaller counties around here, people were really concerned about that, especially in the last year, and people having to take, you know, a day off here or a day off there to sort of, you know, balance the books. Is that what was going on?
Well, we haven't had to take any furlough days in the last few years, you know, when the farm economy kind of tanked and budget things were tight. We had to roll our budget back, and rather than lay off folks that we have a significant amount of training into, we opted for furlough days, and I hope those days are gone, you know, but that was one of the tools that we used to keep our employees and live within our means from the legislature.
I know one of the rulings that Mark Cady talked about in the last year and upset some people here in Woodbury County was that he wanted to keep guns out of the courthouses, and that was a bone of contention around here, wasn't it?
Yes, and, we have different administrative orders, and he entered one that said no guns in the courthouses, and then when brought to his attention that, you know, some courthouses, like Woodbury, have more than just court functions, he said, well, you know, that's fine then, and amended the order just to say that at least where we have our court operations, we do not want firearms. And then we also said, if that's what you would like, we'll enter an order to that effect. And despite some of the angst from some Woodbury County folks, they never asked us to opt out of that. And so at present, there is no firearms in the Woodbury County Courthouse. And I only had one other county Board of Supervisors inquire about maybe doing that, and the rest of them have all abided by his administrative order.
I was sort of impressed by the many things I've heard people say about Chief Justice Cady. Even those people that maybe didn't agree with him all the time, they had to admit he was a tireless advocate for the court system and for justice in Iowa.
Yeah, I think when he became Chief Justice, and that was after the three other Iowa Supreme Court justices had been voted out by the public, and one of those was former Chief Justice Marsha Ternus. You know, he worked tirelessly and meeting with groups and explaining what the court system does, and that's when they started taking the Supreme Court out on the road, traveling to high schools and meeting with high school classes to try to become more transparent and make sure that the public knew what they were doing, and, you know, they weren't just sitting in some ivory tower. And I know I've heard and seen some of his schedules, and I think he was speaking to public groups on a weekly basis, and sometimes more than one, just explaining what the court system does. And he was a real champion for our court system and speaking on its behalf.
So looking back at the life of Justice Cady, it seems like he's someone that really earned a lot of people's respect.
He was a wonderful guy, and I don't know if I heard him speak an ill word about anyone, just so even-tempered in such trying times. And I think I've read stories of even those opposed to him and some of the decisions, you know, respected him, and I think that's a wonderful characteristic when you come into the court system and somebody oftentimes loses, and sometimes both parties feel like they've lost, but if they were listened to and treated with respect, those are good characteristics, and he certainly had those.
That was Judge Dwayne Hoffmeyer, the chief of the 3rd Judicial District in Iowa. He hears cases at the Woodbury County Courthouse. Hoffmeyer knew Katie well and says he was shocked when he found out about the Iowa Supreme Court Chief Justice's death last Friday. Katie had a big impression on many Iowa attorneys, and one of them is Roxanne Conlon. The Des Moines-based attorney recently represented Sioux City native Chris Godfrey. The former Iowa Workers' Compensation Commissioner sued former Iowa Governor Terry Branstad for discrimination against him because he is gay. Conlon says the Varnum decision on gay marriage, which was written by Chief Justice Katie, stands out for many reasons.
The Varnum decision is probably the most lyrical decision I have ever read. I would often speak about it with other people, and they would complain about overreach or the court having done something that was unconstitutional rather than constitutional. And I would say to them, have you read the opinion? And usually they had not. So I suggested that they read it and then come back and talk to me about it again, because it was absolutely 100% supported. And one of the things that he did in that decision that I thought was terribly important was he noted Iowa's remarkable history of advancing human rights. We had a case called Clark versus Muscatine that happened in 1869, involving a 12-year-old African-American student who was forbidden to go to the white school in Muscatine, and the court said, public schools are public, she can go where she wants. That was 84 years before Brown versus Board of Education. And there's a whole series of cases like that. That Justice Katie spoke about in that opinion. That is, however, not his only remarkable achievement. It's certainly the one most commented on.
What do you think the other remarkable achievements are?
Well, there are a number of cases, of course, particularly last year's decision on the right to choice for women, the right for women to control their own bodies and not men in the Iowa legislature. That was also a very groundbreaking decision. But the way that he ran the court was unusual. He wanted the people of Iowa to know they had a Supreme Court, to have the opportunity to watch it work. He instituted travel by the justices. They would hear cases around the state. He instituted live streaming of arguments. He was so forward-thinking about the importance to the people of Iowa of the Supreme Court and how it was also crucial that they knew who the people were making the decisions and how the decisions were being made. And I think that may be one of his most lasting and most important contributions. He was a genuinely kind man. He was exceedingly courteous, but more than that, he had a genuine niceness about him. He treated everyone with great respect. He will be sorely missed by the bar in Iowa. He was universally respected, and it's probably not too much to say that most people viewed him with great affection.
That was Des Moines attorney Roxanne Conlon talking about the legacy of Iowa Supreme Court Chief Justice Mark Katie, who died last Friday. A memorial service was held for him this morning at his alma mater, Drake University, in Des Moines. The unexpected passing of Chief Justice Katie means the process to fill his vacancy will begin soon. Within 10 days of receiving a vacancy notice from the Secretary of State, Governor Reynolds, will have to call on the State Judicial Nominating Commission to begin the outreach for all potential candidates, and that includes all Iowa lawyers and judges. Judges are selected on the merit system, where the commission researches, vets, and interviews and nominates applicants. They will deliberate and ultimately select three names they'll submit to Governor Reynolds, who will then get to pick one of those to be an Iowa Supreme Court justice. There are 17 people on the State Judicial Nominating Commission. Eight of them are lawyers appointed to their position by their peers. The other nine are appointed by the governor. That number used to be eight, but was recently changed by Reynolds earlier this year. It's a change that has some people worried about a political imbalance on that commission. Support for The Exchange comes from Gregory Giles, investment advisor representative with Legacy Financial LLC in Sioux City, serving the financial planning and investment needs of clients since 2004. Information about Legacy Financial and Greg Giles is available at www.legacyfinancialllc.com. Securities offered through United Planners Financial Services, member FINRA, SIPC. Financial planning and advisory services offered through RDA Financial Network. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. All over Iowa, aging courthouses and the accompanying jails are either being restored or rebuilt. With the completion date of May 2021, Warren County officials are in the process of receiving bids from numerous contractors for redevelopment of their courthouse. Henry County Law Center is nearly ready to house inmates. The construction of that new jail was made possible by the 2017 passage of a $9.1 million bond issue. Nearly 86% of voters in Henry County cast ballots in favor of funding the new facility through a property tax increase. And the Woodbury County Board of Supervisors has tapped two consultants who will give financial expertise as officials continue to push forward with a plan to build a new jail. Deliberations continue on funding that new jail to replace an aging 1987 downtown version on 7th Street. It's expected to cost around $48 million. County Board Chair Keith Raddick has said it would make more financial sense to build a new jail on the outskirts of the city rather than to try and repair the aging Woodbury County Law Enforcement Center. However, some new research shows there are alternatives to building bigger and better jails. A recent study by the Prison Policy Initiative presents some restorative justice solutions that would both save money and help keep people out of jail. Alexi Jones is the author of the study. She says counties could begin with reducing or doing away with the cost of bail, which a lot of people simply cannot afford.
And fees, $50 means very, like, it could be a lot of money for someone living in poverty, not a lot of money for someone who is making a middle class income or who is wealthy. And I think taking into account individuals' ability to pay could be a huge step in the right direction.
And you think that alternative sentences like community service could make a difference as well?
With community service and a lot of alternative incarceration, there's a lot of promise there, but it also needs to ensure that by sending someone to community service, there aren't other consequences, such as them losing their regular job. So if you send someone to the community service, they have to do it 9 to 5. Or if someone's on probation or parole and they have a bunch of restrictions that restrict their ability to work. I think one of the things that we emphasize here is that with the criminal justice system, punishments should be proportionate, and they should also try not to interfere with the people's ability to make a living or have housing or support their family, because we know that those factors, if someone is less able to make money or struggling to, like, support their family, that those themselves are criminogenic risks.
And a lot of people that go into the criminal justice system often have substance abuse or mental health issues that haven't been dealt with. Yeah?
Yes, exactly. And that's a huge issue, especially with the opioid epidemic. And there are lots of different ways in which people, there's a really good program in Seattle where people who have substance use or mental health issues are actually diverted at the point of arrest if it's suspected that the criminal activity stems from a drug issue, and the people are, it's very much like a harm reduction approach to drug use, where people are connected with case managers who help them get housing and who eventually help them get into treatment. And there are also several other points in the criminal justice system where people could be diverted.
But often the counties say, well, we just don't have the money for these programs, and the state isn't giving us enough money either.
Yeah, so it can be especially hard in rural areas where there are less healthcare providers. But I think this is kind of a crucial juncture for the county, because they're saying there isn't a ton of money to pay for substance use, but they're also considering a multi-million dollar jail. I think this is like a really prime opportunity where the county could kind of redirect the money from incarceration to treatment. And one of the things with treatment that we really emphasize is a lot of the time treatment is not for substance use disorders in the criminal justice system. It's actually evidence-based, and it's all very, very punitive and doesn't offer medication-assisted treatment, which is the gold standard according to like medical doctors everywhere in treating opioid. Treatment is also important to consider making sure it's effective. But I think this is like a really, there's a big movement called justice reinvestment, where a lot of states have been focusing on reducing their prison population, reinvesting the money from their that saved through reducing their prison population into community services that could reduce the prison population further.
A lot of jails also in the Midwest and rural areas are taking on prisoners for the federal government, for ICE, and getting money from that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's one of the easiest ways for a county to reduce its jail population is by stopping renting jail space. And I'm sure like that will be some money cut off, but it's like a lot cheaper than building a multi-million dollar jail.
I know a lot of the county jails are so desperate for space that if they have one more person come in, they have to let someone out. So they say, well, what can we do? We just have to have somewhere to put these folks, and we need a bigger jail. So what's the answer?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's definitely really, really difficult. One thing I always would caution counties against is building a new jail in order to make more money from holding people from ICE or people from state prisons or people from federal prisons. Because while holding people for other jurisdictions can provide a source of income, the counties really don't have any control over it. ICE could decide to stop contracting with the county, the state prison population could go down, and they may not need to keep people in local jails. And there are just a lot of other factors that are out of a county's control. So I think it's relying on that exclusive, like too much as a form of income can be really dangerous.
That was Alexi Jones of the Prison Policy Institute, the author of the study, Do We Need to Build Another County Jail? Woodbury County continues to look at the possibility of building a new county jail that officials say is needed to deal with the increasing numbers of prisoners and safety issues that affect those who are locked up and those who look after them. You're listening to The Exchange. I'm Mary Hartnett. It's long been discussed that black girls can be perceived as more adult-like and less innocent than white girls in school and other environments, and a new report offers further confirmation that that is the case. Researchers with the Initiative on Gender Justice and Opportunity at Georgetown Law's Center on Poverty and Inequality spoke directly to black girls and women across the country about how they're forced to deal with harmful perceptions, like one that black girls are more mature and less in need of protection than other students from a young age. This phenomenon, which researchers refer to as adultification bias, was examined in a 2017 report from the same team. Author Monique Morris wrote about the issue in her book, Push Out, The Criminalization of... Author Monique Morris wrote about this issue in her book, Push Out, The Criminalization of Black Girls in Schools. Here she is describing the issues faced by black girls in school in a recent TED Talk.
Let's start with some data. According to a National Black Women's Justice Institute analysis of civil rights data collected by the U.S. Department of Education, black girls are the only group of girls who are overrepresented along the entire continuum of discipline in schools. That doesn't mean that other girls aren't experiencing exclusionary discipline, and it doesn't mean that other girls aren't overrepresented at other parts along that continuum. But black girls are the only group of girls who are overrepresented all along the way. Black girls are 7 times more likely than their white counterparts to experience one or more out-of-school suspensions, and they're nearly 3 times more likely than their white and Latinx counterparts to be referred to the juvenile court. A recent study by the Georgetown Center on Poverty and Inequality partially explained why this disparity is taking place when they confirmed that black girls experience a specific type of age compression, where they're seen as more adult-like than their white peers. Among other things, the study found that people perceive black girls to need less nurturing, less protection, to know more about sex, and to be more independent than their white peers. The study also found that the perception disparity begins when girls are as young as 5 years old, and that this perception and the disparity increases over time and peaks when girls are between the ages of 10 and 14. This is not without consequence. Believing that a girl is older than she is can lead to harsher treatment, immediate censure when she makes a mistake, and victim blaming when she's harmed. It can also lead a girl to think that something is wrong with her, rather than the conditions in which she finds herself.
Dr. Morris has just written a new book called Sing a Rhythm, Dance a Blues, that looks at how restorative justice can help these girls who have been removed from the educational system. Morris says she used the blues as a sort of rubric for understanding the situation.
Well, I wrote the book as if it were like an album, so we have tracks instead of chapters and interludes that include the voices of women who work directly with girls, black and brown girls in communities across the country. And, you know, I talk specifically about the blues because many times people think about it only as a form of entertainment. It's sort of understood as part of a musical genre without calling attention to some of its liberatory qualities or some of the things that we might adopt from the blues or learn from the blues style, the blues engagement, to inform how we work with young girls and older girls and how we really build out a platform for their truth-telling such that they can heal in the places where they are expected to learn.
You talk about restorative justice in the book, finding, you know, alternative ways to deal with the wrongs that have been done and trying to go toward healing and a better future. And you described a scene, I believe it was in Rochester, where a young woman came up and talked about all the things that had happened to her.
I was at a restorative justice conference when a woman asked me to sign her criminal conviction history. And it was the first time anyone had ever asked me to sign something like that. So I was taken aback by it at first. But then I realized that what she was calling attention to was the push-out story. She wanted to acknowledge that she could see herself in the book push-out, that she was someone who had been pushed away from school and as a result of being pushed away from school had ended up along, you know, this trajectory of violence that led to her having decades of interactions with the criminal legal system. What we know about this issue is that, you know, for girls, school is an important, really a critical protective factor against contact with the juvenile court or criminal legal system. And so, you know, when girls are pushed away from school, they're more likely to participate in underground economies that render them vulnerable to contact with the juvenile court or criminal legal system. And that's what she was calling attention to. She wanted me to see that she was living proof of what I was talking about, really exploring herself, not as a statistic, but as an opportunity for others to really think about what we're doing when we tell a girl she can't go to school.
When you look back at your schooling, and you've been very successful in your career, but do you remember any times when you felt like some of these girls feel?
I talked in my TED Talk about a fight that I had in the sixth grade with another student, and the response that I got versus the response that many of our girls get today. You know, my fight was a result of many of the conditions that I was dealing with in my life. I talked, you know, in the TED Talk about how I'm a survivor of sexual violence, and much of what I was experiencing and the rage that I was experiencing at that moment in my life was really related to that. And yet, you know, when I got into this fight, my educators understood me, and they understood that it was something that they needed to interrupt, not something, they didn't see me as inherently disruptive. They saw something, a disruption in my life, and that's a difference. And so, you know, the educators that were working with me led with empathy. They asked me what happened. They talked to me about how I could repair the harm. They were engaging in an empathic, restorative approach with me before we were using that language. And so it's really important to explore and remind ourselves sometimes that we're dealing with young people. We're dealing with adolescents who are developing, whose brains are shifting, whose bodies are shifting, whose responses to the conditions around them are shifting. And so when we're called to provide spaces for learning for these individuals, it's really important for us not to lose sight of who we're working with and the more effective strategies to engage with them with the disruption in their lives, as opposed to just thinking that punishment is the same as accountability.
That was author Dr. Monique Morris talking about educational inequalities often faced by Black female students in American schools. She's the author of the book Push Out, The Criminalization of Black Girls in Schools, and she has a new book out called Sing a Rhythm, Dance a Blues that looks at how restorative justice can help these girls who have been removed from the educational system. Listening to The Exchange, I'm Mary Hartnett. A new art exhibit opened this weekend at the Sioux City Arts Center. The artist behind the paintings, Claire Lockhart, recently sat down with Siouxland Public Media's Sheila Brummer. Lockhart, who is from Vermilion, South Dakota, talked about this current show, her inspiration for creation, and some upcoming works.
So my paintings at the Sioux City Arts Center are my Feminine Attempts series, and they are life-sized full-body portraits. They're oil on canvas, and they are of disgruntled women in domestic spaces. And the easiest way for me to describe them for people who haven't seen these paintings before is imagine a hybrid between Betty Crocker and Betty Page.
That's for sure. I saw some of the pictures and images online, and fabulous stuff there. Just beautiful
painting.
But I just, yeah, I love it how they look like they're doing different chores. And then the footwear is kind of featured.
Yes. So I have a combination between modest, conservative, like June Cleaver style clothing, and I pair it with provocative, dangerous footwear. And this is a visual representation of the expectations of femininity and these conflicting expectations that women have, where we're supposed to be pure and chaste and modest, but we're also supposed to be beautiful and sexy. And walking that line is near impossible. So I combine them both together and make this ridiculous outfit, but it's a way to speak to these expectations of femininity.
So I think the Betty Page would be the footwear for
yes,
sure.
Yes, definitely.
And I even noticed that there, it looks like that you have a self-portrait, it looks like, in that exhibit.
There are three self-portraits. This series took a few years to develop, so my hair looks a little different in some of them, but I have self-portraits in this painting series because I started off with my experiences and how I don't feel like I fit within this narrow box of what it means to be a woman. And so I created the first self-portrait where I'm doing dishes. And that is a chore that I particularly don't enjoy doing, which you can tell from my facial expression in the portrait. And after I created this first painting, I had other women who would approach me and tell me things such as, I hate cleaning the bathtub. I have boots. You should paint me. And so I would have other women volunteer to be part of this series because they could relate to the struggles that I was experiencing within my own life.
And you're so busy. You teach, you do all these different things. You're a fixture at University of South Dakota too.
Yes.
And how do you find time to do this kind of exhibit? And how long does it take to usually do just one of the pieces?
So just one of the paintings typically takes between 100 and 150 hours.
Wow.
And so it takes several months to get one done. And I would work on multiple paintings simultaneously because there's that phrase where it's so much fun to watch paint dry. And while I'm waiting for a layer to dry, I could work on another painting. And so having the time to paint and be part of the art community is extraordinarily difficult. And I feel like I just don't get to sleep as much as I need to.
That's always a good thing, isn't it? I know you also work on fabulous aprons. You do some silk printing.
Yes.
Too. And you were actually featured at Art Splash a few years ago. And your handiwear was actually used to help raise money here at Siouxland Public Media. I think we had it as one of the items that we did during our fund drive in the spring. And they were gone right away because people loved them.
That's wonderful to hear. So I make aprons, and that actually comes from this painting series. In all of the portraits, the women are wearing aprons. And with the very first self-portrait, I was trying to make myself look as domestic as possible. And I thought I should wear an apron, but I didn't actually own one because who wears an apron when cleaning their house anymore? And so I had to make one. And I made the aprons that most of the models are wearing too. And around this time, I learned how to silk screen properly. And I love serigraphy. And it's when you're putting the ink directly onto the fabric. And so I printed fabric and I made aprons. I also made dresses as well. And a few years ago, I was the splash artist for Art Splash with the Sioux City Arts Center. And that was a fantastic experience because I got to see people and they would try on the aprons and buy them. And I like having my art be accessible, and having art that's wearable is a lot of fun. My fear with the aprons, though, is that people buy them and they're like, it's artwork. I can't wear it. But my intent is for people to wear it and be messy with it, because part of my concept as an artist is that women are supposed to be beautiful and put together at all times and be immaculate and never have any spots or stains. However, we're real people. We do stuff. It's messy. And so the apron is a record of the work that we've been doing. I specifically designed a couple aprons and dresses that I wore in my studio, and they are covered in paint and ink and gesso and sawdust and who knows what else is on there. But it's a record that I am not just a model. I am an artist, and I'm busy, and my work is messy.
And when it comes to your artwork, do you have a special medium that you like to work in the most? I don't know if you have something that you, or you just like the variety.
I love painting the most, and that is one of my favorite classes to teach as well. And I love painting so much because it's a very forgiving medium. A lot of people think that with painting it's too hard, but it's not. What's great about oil painting, which is what I like the most and specialize in, is if something goes wrong when you're painting, you can wipe it off and no one has to know. And if you don't notice the error until it's dry, you can paint over the top of it. Or if it's really bad, you can sand it down and then redo that area. And so as an educator, I feel like there are no bad paintings, just paintings that people haven't finished. And so that's why I love oil painting the best. But as we talked about, I also love serigraphy, so silkscreen printmaking. That has a higher curve for craftsmanship, I feel, but it's more versatile and it's more affordable. So it's able, people are able to collect it easier.
Do you have a favorite artist that you get inspiration from?
One of my favorite all-time artists is from the Renaissance. It's Artemisia Gentileschi. And she is in the Caravaggio style of painting. And she was an artist during a time when women weren't really allowed outside the home. Like, they couldn't train as artists, and then having a public life outside the home was seen as taboo in that era. But she broke all these barriers. She learned to become an artist in a time where it was pretty much taboo, and she was able to sustain herself on her career. And her artwork has all these very powerful, strong women in it overcoming obstacles. Some of them are acts of violence, and they're very active, which is different from like traditional Western painting. And so I really enjoy like her biography, and the work that she creates is just powerful imagery on her own.
And it's like your images too.
Yes, I do take some inspiration from her, of course.
And what's next for you? Do you have some other projects that you're working on? I know it's hard to always find the time to invest in yourself and the talent that you have, but anything that you want to work on, or anything that you're kind of thinking about doing?
I'm glad you ask. I have so much on my plate right now. I'm working on 2 new painting series. I'm developing another series for printmaking, and then I'm also curating a couple art shows that will be in Vermilion. The first one is actually open for submissions right now. It's called Subversive Celebration, and it's a mail-in art show where artists all over the world can mail in altered cards to me. And I'm going to display them at the University of South Dakota this spring. And I have another show that's going to be an 8x10 mail-in show that has an optional artist exchange with it, because being part of the artistic community is important to me. And so I want to try and build that community and have options for other artists to display as well. And then for my own personal painting, I'm working on a series called Brodalesques. And it's a play on the Orientalist painters, where they would paint the odalisque in the harem. And so it's the passive laying down woman. And in art history, we're told that, oh no, it's just a beautiful painting. It's about form and color. But if you look at it and think about it for more than 30 seconds, it's about the male gaze. And so I'm doing a parody series of it where I'm putting men in these traditional poses that women are often put in art history. One of my models, when he volunteered for this, he said, paint me like one of your French girls. And so I'm painting these men in these traditional odalisque poses, but they're bros, so I have to paint them in their man caves, because that's the contemporary forbidden space for a female artist like me.
That's Claire Lockhart, an artist from Vermilion, South Dakota. Her show, Feminine Attempts, can be found at the Sioux City Arts Center till February 2nd. For more information on Lockhart and her art, check out her website, clairelockhart.com, and it's Claire with a K.
You keep saying you got something for me, something you call love. But confess, you've been a messin' where you shouldn't have been a messin', and now someone else is getting all your best. These boots are made for walking, and that's just what they'll do. One of these days these boots are gonna walk all over you. Yeah. You keep lying when you ought to be truthing, and you keep losing when you ought to not bet. You keep saying when you ought to be a changing. Now what's right is right, but you ain't been right yet. These boots are made for walking, and that's just what they'll do. One of these days these boots are gonna walk all over you. You keep playing where you shouldn't be playing, and you keep thinking that you'll never get burned. I just found me a brand new box of matches, yeah. And what he knows you ain't had time to learn. These boots are made for walking, and that's just what they'll do. One of these days these boots are gonna walk all over you. Are you ready, boots? Start walking.
And you're listening to The Exchange. I'm Mary Hartnett. The Sioux City Conservatory of Music is tuning up for its annual show Saturday night in Sioux City. Co-founder of the conservatory, Gia Emery, talked about the show with Siouxland Public Media's Sheila Brummer.
We are calling it Somebody to Love, so come and we will love on you.
And it's Saturday night, 6 o'clock, and you are trying to break a world record.
We're setting the record. Bohemian Rhapsody, the most people to play in one setting. My husband laughs about this because he said, Gia, there's so many people that have done this. And I said, yeah, but we're going to try to be in the Guinness Book of World Records with this. And just recently found out, Sheila, that it's going to take us about 1,000 people to do that. I'm not sure that we'll get there, but we're going to be optimistic. I told Ron, let's be optimistic. And anybody that wants to come and enjoy that night with us, if they feel like they want to come in and jump in on a rehearsal, we do have rehearsal Friday at 4 o'clock for Bohemian Rhapsody and that set. So, you know, you
so
can
rehearse
come
and then Saturday night's the show.
Right on. And if you're a drummer, we'll come and contact us. You can contact us on the Facebook page. We have an event on the Facebook page. We have places for drum kits. We are hoping that drummers want to come set up their kit, practice the song, listen to it throughout the, you know, the next couple of days, and get it down and be with us that evening, Saturday night, 6 o'clock.
And it's just a night too, to showcase the different students that you have of all different ages.
Oh, I love it. Our conservatory is so unique. People that have visited us are, you know, fellow friends that are musicians themselves. Flea, as a matter of fact, has really adored what we do here at the conservatory. Give it away, give it away, give it away now. Because it's unique. We have a 5-year running 78-year-old man that has celebrated 78 years for 5 years now. And then he's playing guitar. He came to us as a student, you know, 6 years ago, and we love him dearly. He's going to be on stage probably next to our youngest in lesson, who's 7.
So and what does the 7-year-old play?
The 7-year-old plays guitar as well.
As well. Wow.
Yeah.
That's great. Say you're listening and you want to join in and start lessons. How do people do that?
They can simply do that by sending me a message on Facebook. We also have open houses. They can come to the Conservatory Blue Cafe during the day, and I have registration forms there. The conservatory located at 1307 1309 Pierce is open in the afternoons every day this week until 9 p.m. So right there at the Orpheum Show, we have registration too. We're going to have a table where people can register for their lessons starting as soon as next week, if they want. We've got registration there that evening.
And music is so universal, isn't it?
Yeah, it's the best language ever. It's where everyone can get along. Everyone can discuss all of the diversity that we do have and have rhythm, have harmony with it. So,
and how old were you when you first started doing music?
Well, I've always adored music. I remember, you know, growing up in a household where my dad would, you know, we really loved Motown. My dad was that kind of guy growing up. My mother really loved Janis. So cleaning the house to that kind of music in my household was always, you know, that's how we did things. I worked at Uncle John Records. That was one of my first jobs. So I worked right there with Ray McAvoy, Saturdays, selling records. So my passion for listening has always been there. I took a hold of music as a performer and was a lead singer in a punk band. And that was just a good experience, you know. I encourage everybody to be a singer in a punk band.
And then you met your husband, Ron Emery, by yes. listening to his band, TSOL, when they were in Sioux City years ago.
I did. I met my husband, wasn't planning on meeting the man of my dreams, but that happened. And, oh, I'm so grateful for it. A friend in the community introduced us. We then wrote love letters back and forth.
He was living in California at the time?
Yep. And I was living in Lincoln. So I lived in Lincoln, Nebraska then. And he wrote letters to me and I wrote letters back and we got to know each other. Long distance. This was before cell phones. Isn't that weird?
Yeah.
You
actually would correspond with people that way.
Mm-hmm. I'm so thankful for that. My children both have a box each so that they can understand what a healthy courtship is.
With those love letters. Yeah. And then what does Ron think about being here in Sioux City? Because he grew up, you know, in one of the biggest cities in the world, and he's here.
We just spoke about that together the other morning, watching the sun go up, having coffee. And this is his home. He really realizes how important our community work is here. He considers it such a privilege to be able to, you know, be almost a conduit for happiness in Sioux City. We're really trying to help people understand how great this place is, being that we've been several other places. You know, Ron has toured all over the world. He's lived in LA his whole life. Setting aside, we don't have a beach and we don't have our ocean for him to surf, because Ron is a really good surfer. He loves it. He absolutely loves it.
Have you tried it?
Surfing?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you enjoy it?
I surf when we go to Hawaii. I like to surf. I don't surf in Huntington Beach. The water isn't as clean as it should be.
All right. Well, Gia, thank you so much. Best of luck.
Thank you.
Are you actually going to be performing Bohemian Rhapsody as well?
Yeah. Yes, I will be. And I'm hoping to encourage anyone that's listening to think that they can do that with me. We have already run out of our triangles, though, everyone. We need...
So if you want to play the triangle, you have to bring your own triangle.
You've got to bring your own triangle, your own guitar, your voice. We would just love people to stand up in the audience and sing with us to celebrate our kids. This really means a lot to our kids. If they see that the community is backing them in their effort to be performance artists, it's really... It's amazing. It's a game stopper, because this is their sport. Music is their life. Please come out and see them. Mama
just killed a man, put a gun again. That's Gia Emery from the Sioux City Conservatory of Music. The show is Saturday night at the Orpheum Theater. Doors open at 6, with the main stage show starting at 7 p.m. Thanks a lot to Sheila Brummer and everyone who helped out with the show. I'm Mary Hartnett. We'll see you next week.